Have you heard about the new MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle? The MagnaGrip Pro Nozzle is the easiest, most advanced nozzle ever, protecting you from the dangers of diesel exhaust fumes. With its patented flex magnet technology, the Pro Nozzle easily attaches with one hand from a standing position, can snap on from any angle, and fits flush to the apparatus, saving a ton of space. And MagnaGrip is the only exhaust removal system that offers a true 100% seal. For free grant assistance and to learn more, go to MagnaGrip.com.
This fire engineering podcast is made possible by Tincata Protective Fabrics. The global leader in flame-resistant fabrics, Tincata Protective Fabrics enables millions of people worldwide to be great at what they do. Generations of industry professionals serving in the fire service, industrial, and military industries rely on Tincata fabrics for safety, comfort, and confidence. From the harshest working conditions to the welcoming site of home, Tincata recognizes the people they're protecting are unique individuals whose lives extend beyond work. Supporting a world of evolving needs, Tincata's innovations lead the way in user-centric design, technology, and sustainability around the globe. To learn more, please visit TincataFabrics.com.
Welcome to the Command Show.
Science 5, Engine 101.
Let's start the show.
Hey, everybody. Anthony Castro's here with Brian Brush, my dear friend from Midwest City, Oklahoma. We are here to bring to you an amazing tale of a dramatic rescue that occurred just a few days ago out here in California. And we have the two gentlemen that were on scene that could best to probably describe it to us. And we're excited to have them. But before we do, like we always talk about on the Command Show, we want to talk about the NIOSH 5, National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, top five line of duty death killers. What's causing us to get in trouble, have sloppy fire ground operations, near misses, injuries, and ultimately potentially line of duty deaths. If you go to any of the line of duty death reports from NIOSH over the past greater part of 30 years, you'll see that the NIOSH 5 were present. And those are inadequate risk assessment, inadequate or insufficient size up is part of risk assessment, inadequate communications, lack of accountability, lack of or inadequate incident command, and either not following your SOGs or not having them. And those five things, we call them the NIOSH 5, and they live in the tactical space. And for those of you who've been listening to the Command Show for years or have gone to any of our classes, you know that we hit that hard. It's not just about going home safe. It's also about safe and efficient and effective fire ground operations so we can save victims. And seconds matter nowadays on the fire ground like they never have before. The margin for error is practically zero. We all know that low-mass synthetics are burning at a geometric rate. They burn and reach flashover much faster. And the window to actually make a save or a rescue is closing very rapidly. And that's exactly what we're going to talk about tonight with our friends from Sacramento Metro Fire, where I used to work. We're fortunate to have two good friends who have been working for Metro for quite a while, Lieutenant Chief Kylie Keeley and Captain Sean Lemon. Those of you out there listening, if you've been tuned in to the internet, you've probably seen the story about the rescue that they had over the last about 2 or 3 days ago. And without further ado, I'd like to introduce them and thank them for being on the show. So, Kylie, thanks for joining us, brother.
Happy to be here. Appreciate you having us on.
And Sean, how long have you been a captain with Metro now?
Going on about 2 years here this next week.
2 years. And you're at Station 42, correct?
That is correct. On the Charlie.
Yep. On the Charlie. And Kylie, you're Battalion 7 on the Charlie. How long have you been at BC, Kylie?
Just a little over 4 years.
Excellent. So what we want to do tonight, fellas, is really give you the stage. Brian and I are going to probably ask a bunch of follow-up questions as we go, but we really want to give you an opportunity to share with us the backdrop of what you had the other day, what you did, what you encountered, why you did it, and then we'll ask a bunch of questions because this is going to be a great opportunity for everybody listening to learn from your experience. So without further ado, Captain Lemon, why don't you just tell us, you know, how this whole thing started, what time you were dispatched, what you were dispatched to, and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. So it was approximately 3:15, 3:30 in the morning. We were awoken and dispatched to a violent crime assault. Per the MDC we received from dispatch, it stated that a male adult had a knife against the throat of a child. That 909S was en route, and we were standing by to be cleared to enter. We decided to stand by and stage in quarters. Approximately 5 minutes after the initial dispatch, we got an update stating that the assailant is now attempting to light a fire within the house while holding the knife to the child. At this point, we decided, you know, there's enough risk going on, enough potential. We decided to go up and stage across from the apartment complex and away further. So we jumped in the rig. We headed over to our staging location. Knowing that it's a two-story apartment complex, I've got a guy behind me, my firefighter, Tucker Hodge. He's on a callback, so it's not his normal shift. I showed him the complex guide and kind of gave him a basic layout of the apartments while we were sitting in the rig. I would say after sitting there for about 3 to 5 minutes, we received an update saying we were now clear to enter, that the assailant and child had barricaded themselves within the apartment and that the fire was spreading. We went in route. I balanced it to a full commercial assignment so that we would have adequate resources in route. When we approached the normal entrance for this apartment complex, it's a one-way drive, or it's designed to be a one-way drive, kind of in the shape of a U that goes around the entire complex. We approached the entrance. It was blocked by other apartment buildings as far as being able to see beyond it. As we arrived, we were blocked by about 25 cop cars that were occupying the majority of that first turn. So we kind of stopped for a second, tried to gain a little more of like a situational awareness as to what we were going to do here. I decided getting eyes on was going to be our best shot, kind of see what we really had developing, and we can have the other crews deploy hose lines somewhere else if need be. So we parked there at the entrance, and on foot, we hustled up to where the fire was dispatched to be. As I came around the corner, it was fairly obvious just by the amount of glow that I was getting that it was a well-established fire. It was about 40 feet from the parking area. So running over to it, I came in contact with one of the police officers, and he had made the statement that the assailant and the child were still inside the building. He said he believes they're barricaded in the master bedroom. At that point, I looked over at my firefighter, and as odd as it would be, it was just a kick reaction. I just looked at him and said, go get the saw. And what I mean by that is there's a handful of rigs within Metro Fire that carry chainsaws on their engine. They're known as the RIC engines, right? So that's part of our tool complement. A lot of other engines don't have this. And we were talking the past couple weeks about situations where we'd be able to use those tools that were special to our engine. And this was going to be one of those situations. So after the information I received from the cop, I looked right over to my firefighter, tasked him to go back and get the chainsaw. So he went en route back to the engine for that tool. I advanced towards the adjacent apartment on the Delta side of the fire room. Made sure it was something we could access, and it turns out the police had already made access to it. It was a vacant apartment. I announced on the radio that we were on scene, that we had a heavy police presence in the area, that access was going to be an issue. I advised Battalion 5 that we had a well-seated fire with barricaded people within the structure, and that we should go ahead and balance it to a second alarm. Battalion 5 came back, confirming a second alarm, and then requested it. At this point, I took my Halligan, went inside the abandoned apartment, or the vacant apartment.
Hold on 1 second, but let's take a pause, because that's a lot of information coming, and I want to ask questions as we go, because there's so much information.
Oh, stop me anytime, man.
No, this is great. I'm there with you, brother. But my first question is, so what were you originally dispatched for? Was it just a law enforcement assist?
Yeah, it was just a violent crime assault. So, I mean, you've been on those with us, you know, multiple times down Sacramento.
Yep.
It's not an uncommon call where we usually just end up staging, and if we don't get canceled by PD altogether, it's usually just a medical aid.
And you were staged in quarters because of the proximity of the apartment complex to your fire station, and it being a violent crime, you thought I was staged on the ramp. Okay. And so when you guys came in and did advance into the complex, that's when you saw the cop cars, and that's what made it difficult for you guys to get up and close with your engine.
Yeah.
Because they had already loaded up the scene.
I had estimated it's literally about a 100-yard drive from the entrance of the apartment complex to get eyes on the apartment that was involved, and it was aligned mm-hmm. with side-by-side cop cars.
Right.
So it definitely made access right. and getting okay. those in there difficult.
Yeah.
So,
okay.
Cap,
but
with
so,
that,
yeah, go ahead.
Cap, with that, you know, that statement you just touched on it there about eyes on kind of being the best, and then earlier you said, you know, you wanted to get eyes on it before you made those decisions. I really applaud you for kind of making that decision. I know we get into these situations, apartment complexes, even just with a normal fire, potentially trying to get it right the first time leads to compounding problems. So leaving your rig and working your way in there to try to make the right decision for the rest of the alarm, the balance of the alarm, that's just a very heads up move, especially considering all that you guys had going on. So I thought that was definitely a pearl to pull out of there.
Absolutely. Yeah. I've had a few fires in the past where you show up and you think you have something and you don't get eyes on the actual fire and you end up starting the ball off in the completely wrong direction. It takes so much longer to rewind it. So for me, one of the concepts I've kind of taken away from just the short 2 years that I've been in the seat that I'm in is having eyes on and understanding the problem is much more valuable than pulling a hose to what you think might be the problem.
And then one other thing there too, that I want to highlight as we go through this, because it's been a reoccurring kind of discussion point back to the rescue from Columbus, Indiana, where the guys had talked about it. But I applaud a lot of the newer officers, especially working in designated RIC companies, that are starting to find those connections and opportunities to bring our RIC training, RIC tools, and RIC approaches to the rescue of civilians. So, you know, heads up move to be kind of thinking we have these additional resources at our disposal. Maybe this is the time to engage those and engaging those in early, even pre-staging them, because rescue of a life is rescue of a life. It doesn't have to be wrapped in bunker gear and an air pack. So a great call on getting that up to the scene early. It might have only been your only tool, not being able to stretch the hose lines there, but a really, really good move there.
So Chief Keeley, at this point, when did you become aware of the call? You were in quarters. Did you get dispatched on when he balanced it to a commercial alarm?
Yeah, I was a 2nd Battalion Chief. This was in Battalion 5. I'm Battalion 7, so the battalion north to me. when I came up on the radio, I had the TAC channel on. The first thing that I heard was the update from Captain London saying that they were had a barricaded subject, two people inside of an apartment with heavy fire, and requesting a second alarm, and that they were going to be breaching the wall for rescue, and that there was a lot of police officers on scene. So obviously the current concern responding is knowing that these guys are in a pretty precarious situation with a heavy police presence and potential threat to the safety and well-being of our members as well as the members of the public, because it's 3:30 in the morning, people are sleeping. The layout of this apartment complex was, it's just a straight row of 12 apartments on one side, and it mirrors 12 apartments on the other side. So knowing that the fire was well established and that there was just engine 42 on scene making a rescue, the fire attack was going to be secondary, that this fire had a really good chance of getting well established before any suppression efforts were started.
Right, right. When you say 12, was that under one roof? There was 12 facing one direction and 12 facing the opposite direction under one building?
Correct. Yep.
So straight
row of apartments.
Upstairs, six downstairs.
So like a cluster, like almost like an alcove, almost, but four per group, but they're combined at basically the water heaters and
right.
three sets of those going down the row.
Okay. And so at this point, Cap, you guys have decided to start with the rescue, and you've gone in the adjacent unit. And when you said it's vacant, was it not occupied and vacant like furniture, or just the people had vacated so you could operate in there?
It seemed like they were in the process of getting ready to re-rent, so there was absolutely nothing inside, maybe a fresh coat of paint.
And what was your interaction with the cops that you mentioned as you guys are entering into their space?
So as I was advancing, there was one officer at the front, and as I was coming up to him, yelled at him, "Hey, what do we got?" And he said, "We've got the assailant and the child. We're pretty sure they're barricaded within the master bathroom of the apartment complex." And so after getting that information, that's what I relayed out, looked over to my firefighter, told him to head back to the engine to get the saw. And then I proceeded into the unoccupied apartment to find the bathroom and then start doing what I could with the tools that I had. And it was funny, Chief Castros and I had an opportunity to talk about this a little bit earlier. And it's one of those things where I feel like it wasn't like I took the time to think all this through, but it was more of just a reaction. And I think it's one of those things where, you know, we've heard the phrase, when it comes down to a task, you fall back to the level of your training. And as a department, we've been doing a lot of things recently that were about, you know, fire ground survival and about primary searches and secondary searches. And all those things kind of played into this one. We just recently had a department-wide training that was helped put on by firefighter Tyler Kraft. And one of the things that he talked about, and it stood out to me, and it was like, you show up to a fire, you can have all sorts of different type of conditions, but do you ever stop to think about what compartments in this thing are survivable? And like I said, it's not one of those things where it's like, in that split second, I took the time to think of all the things that people have said or all the trainings that I've thought about. But to me, the idea that this person had gone and barricaded himself the farthest away from the fire with two doorways, hopefully between him and where the fire had started, that in that bathroom was probably going to be the most survivable space. And so that was where my target was.
Excellent.
I was going to say, I can continue on, or if you guys had questions up to this point, but
you're describing victim profiling, something that we're teaching around the country, you have to know, you can't just go blindly into a fire, and even if you know there's victims, you have to get as much information as possible from bystanders. In this case, your bystanders were the cops. And they give you really good intel, which proves to be pivotal in your tactical decision to go next door and go through the wall. So excellent job. So keep going.
Chief,
can I
pop in here real quick for a question for the battalion chief?
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Just kind of do like a training timeout right here. There's a lot of discussion, and I know it's a coin flip constantly about fire departments staging for law enforcement and the go, no go in those situations. And obviously here you had staged. We've all, you know, staged at the firehouse and then staged at the scene, and then you get the clear to go in. I guess my question then for the battalion chief is, where you're picking up the ball on this dispatch, you're hearing all that's going on. I mean, obviously the decision by that first due officer was great in being face-to-face with law enforcement, but could you expand a little bit on maybe the organizational approach to staging for law enforcement and the comfort level of the decision of firefighters to go or engage or not? It's one of those kind of risk management discussions that gets tossed around a lot.
Yeah, I mean, in 42's area, which is in Battalion 5, very busy firehouse, they run a lot with their local sheriffs, and oftentimes we get to know these officers by first name basis and develop a good working relationship with them. So there is some trust developed at that point. But just coming up through our agency and how we have done things all along the way and conducting training and reevaluating decisions that were made that were either right or wrong. The decision to go or no go, we put a lot of trust and faith in our company officers and crew to make those critical decisions, because oftentimes on violent crimes, we're not even made aware that they're on scene of a violent crime. So the fact that Captain Lemon recognized that this was going to be a pretty significant event and called for more resources early on. Before the first line was ever attacking the fire, we had two alarms of a commercial assignment responding and on the road. So that was a great decision. But going back to your question about responding to violent crimes and from an organizational level, we support our company officers and the decisions that they make. And oftentimes, crews in their firehouses, when they're at close proximity to the incident itself, they'll stage at or at their firehouse. Captain Lemon recognized that this was an escalating event, so he decided to move closer, still not in the zone where they could get injured or become part of the emergency itself before being cleared by law enforcement. But that was another great decision, and it cut down on the time frame that they would have had to get in the rig and respond to the scene where they were just staged right across the street. So the decisions that were made that night are very well in conforming with our practice at Metro Fire and other agencies within our region.
Awesome. Thank you.
Please continue, my good sir.
All right.
That's you, Sean.
So firefighters off to go get the saw. I make entry, find the adjacent bathroom. And what I have with me is just my Halligan. So at that point, I just start trying to bust out drywall so we can locate the studs, do whatever I can do to maybe alleviate some of the smoke that's inside that room, but something to give me an idea of what they're dealing with through that side. Like if I'm getting heavy, dark charge smoke pumping through, am I seeing flame? It gives me at least an idea before we start cutting this whole thing up. With that being said, I poked a couple of holes. We had almost like a light wispy smoke starting to fill the apartment that I was in. At that point, I knew that space was still survivable. I started masking up. I noticed my firefighter had just returned, and he started masking up. So we started doing that at about the same time. As he is making entry to me with a saw, I hear the other engine showing up on scene and pulling their attack line to start attacking that first floor of the apartment complex. At the time of their arrival, after talking to their captain, they had the fully involved first floor. They had a very well-involved second floor, and it already started making access into the common attic of the apartment complex. So they were already calling for additional hose lines to be pulled by the next incoming engines. So we have the chainsaw. We start it up. We start making our hole. I notify by now Battalion 5, who I believe was, if not command at the time, was shortly on scene, that we had the chainsaw, that we're going to start making progress on our breach. We start making our hole. We make it large enough that we're able to start pulling the 2x4s out and can kind of see into it a little bit. At that point, we're waiting for some smoke to get out. I use a tick. Obviously, we were cleared to enter by the cops, but usually when we get that clear to enter, it's because they've either taken control of the assailant or the threat is no longer around. This was completely different. This one was one where it was never really that we were clear to enter. The assailant was still on scene. He still had a potential victim with him that he could hurt. But the situation, the dynamics of it had completely changed to where fire had to get involved. So a little bit different than what we're normally used to when we're cleared. So as I'm approaching, I kind of slightly stick my hand inside the hole and try to scan with our tick through the smoke to try and see, I don't know if this guy's still conscious, maybe hiding off in the corner, waiting to cut one of us as we come through. So it was kind of that whole, like, we took about 30 seconds to a minute trying to let some of the smoke clear out, trying to get a good situational awareness with our tick before deciding to advance in. I would say maybe, like I said, 30 seconds to a minute had gone by. We were able to locate a body in the bathtub the size of an adult. We nudged him and started calling out. He didn't make any movements. I asked my firefighter if he felt comfortable jumping in, and he said he would go first, so he went for it. And he jumped in, and I followed right behind him. At this point, I notified command that we'd had the breach, that we were inside, that we'd located the adult victim and the child, and that we would need additional resources to our apartment complex to help us extricate. Maybe with about 30 seconds of searching, we were able to locate the child, and it turns out what the male assailant had done is he had gone into the bathroom, barricaded himself within the bathroom so that the crews wouldn't be able to access from the outside. He then got in the bathtub and turned on the shower. And so when we got there, we were hit with steam. Our masks fogged up, made visibility quite a bit harder than what we were thinking it was going to be. And then we were able to locate the child only because we saw the child floating in the water at the feet of the male assailant. And it looked as though the male assailant's head was resting on top of the child. So my firefighter, after looking at it in video, was quick to realize, pulled the adult male up, grabbed the child by the feet and pulled him out of the water. He was completely limp, didn't have really any signs of life, passed him to me, and I called out for anybody and anyone that would be able to hear me in the adjacent apartment that we had originally started our breach on. We were lucky that there was still a police officer within earshot. I believe the female police officer came running in and grabbed the baby from me and took her outside to fire crews that were coming in. At that point, our focus turned to the male assailant. He was probably about 250 pounds, soaking wet. Luckily, he was wearing a pair of boxer shorts, so we had something to grab onto. But it was going to be difficult for me and my firefighter to try and get this guy out on our own. So again, I echoed out that we would need additional resources to help with his removal. We were met by the captain of Engine 103, Captain Montgomery. He met us at the hole that we had created to provide any assistance. It's interesting. Again, like I had talked about, it's one of those things where everything kind of played out perfectly for us. This is a big guy. Would have been really hard to get him from the ground level up to and out of this hole, which is about at the level of my waist. But we were lucky enough to have cut it just above the toilet. So we were able to move the adult victim out of the bathtub into a seated position on the toilet seat in one move. And then with a second move from the toilet seat up to the top of the toilet bowl where the water reservoir is, which is about where our hole had been cut. And at that point, Captain Montgomery was able to get his hands on and pull as well as we pushed, and we were able to get him out and successfully to the fire crews and the medics waiting.
Outstanding. Outstanding. It's just a great story. For those of you joining us, you just missed a great story, and you're going to have to go to the recording to hear it, but we just heard from Captain Sean Lemon from Sacramento Metro Fire and Battalion Chief Kyler Keeley describing a rescue that happened just a couple days ago in which they pulled two victims out of a bathroom through an adjacent wall with extreme fire conditions and potential for violent crime and an assailant who was armed. So be sure to listen to this podcast. If you haven't heard that part, go back and listen to the recording. Can't say enough on how impressed I am, Sean, with your leadership, with your initiative. Just when Chief Keeley called me to tell me about it, I couldn't believe it. He sent me a picture of the MBT screen. He told me what you did, and I was blown away. So hats off to you and your crew.
Thank you so much. Couldn't have done it without my guys.
Hey, Cap, can we just by chance get an idea on total lapse time at this point? I mean, from your kind of clear into the point where this guy's being – this last, victim, the assailant's being pulled out?
Yeah, so with my GoPro video, I started it once we were cleared to enter and I'd balanced it to a commercial structure. And from the time of the video starting to the time – the last victim was pulled out of the IDLH was approximately 8.5 minutes, I believe. Pretty close to that.
That's tremendous. Great work.
Yeah, thank you.
You know, you had asked, Brian, you'd asked Kylie about some of the culture at Metro. And could you guys both expound? I mean, I know the answer to this because I worked there, but I want you both to explain it. What's the culture, operational culture of Metro Fire? How obviously you had mentioned some training that prepared you for this situation, and it was specific to victim profile and where is the victim and where is survivable. Could you guys kind of talk about just the culture and the expectations of company officers a little more with regards to structure firefighting, whether it's being in command, being first in, making tactical decisions? We'll let Chief Keeley go first, but I want to see if you guys can tie that into what transpired on this incident.
Yeah, on working structure fires, whether it's commercial or residential, our typical arrival would be the initial engine company initiates fire attack and or investigates the location, seat of the fire. The second in engine captain would then take command, ensure that the water supply was being established and send their firefighter forward to assist with hose line management or other task level items. The first in battalion chief would then assume command from that second in captain And then the second battalion chief, we get two battalion chiefs on all working on all residential and commercial structure assignments. So that second battalion chief is often used as a tactical supervisor, whether it's a division or group, depending on the incident itself and the needs of the incident. So, and then all subsequent resources are assigned based on those canned reports that are coming out from that first in company officer as to needs for additional lines, searches, ventilation, and such.
From a cultural standpoint, though, are the company officers expected to be aggressive? Are they expected to ask for permission before they do anything? Are they expected to make decisions and have initiative? What do you expect of your company officers, chief, and how did that play into what happened here?
Yeah, no, our culture is we are an aggressive interior firefighting agency. So I think we've gotten really good at conducting ongoing risk assessments, and that's from our firefighters that are on the ambulance to our company officers to our battalion chiefs and assistant chiefs and on up. Because we have those conversations a lot and we talk a lot about, we do AARs on a lot of our incidents and we learn from our successes and failures in the past. So, company officers are expected to use their risk assessment and their experience and their understanding of the building that we're going to, whether they pre-planned it, if it's in their first in, they know this building from runner medical aids, on making effective, aggressive decisions in order to mitigate the incident. And the fact that Captain Lemon had a known rescue in a known location, he was able to effectively bypass fire attack and go for the rescue without having to worry about this expanding fire impinging on their safety, because these two people were in a bathroom confined away from the fire. So if you were to look at, like I got there and I moved forward and I was a division. So I'm standing in front of the fire unit with just a massive volume of fire rolling out of this bedroom, impinging on the patio above and into the second story apartment, and then with a well-involved, well-established attic fire. So if you were to look from the outside in of this apartment, you would think there's probably no survivability inside that unit. But there have been some pictures posted by our PIO of the bathroom itself, and it's basically untouched. It was just smoky. There was no heat. So Captain Lemon and his crew on 42 did an amazing job working with the police officers and going through that unaffected side to affect the rescue. But like I said, our company officers are trained and trusted to make really good initial decisions. Now, when the battalion chief gets there or another company officer gets there and says that, you know, let's take another look at this thing, we're also pretty good at being able to take at least a tactical reset in order to say, hey, let's take a pause here and really see what we're doing. We had that on a fire in Madison. And so being able to pull crews out of that hazardous area to see what is our real purpose here and what are we risking, and then we can almost take that reset and then re-engage where appropriate. We do that quite often and quite successfully.
Excellent. And then what I love that you just said, Chief, is that, you know, from an exterior view, you could, one could easily write off the apartment and say, oh, it's not survivable because of the volume of fire. But this is what we have to get across to everybody in America, is that there are survivable spaces behind a hollow core door, behind, on the closet, in the bathroom, in the back bedroom, in an area that appears to be otherwise lost or fully involved. There are survivable spaces. And the only way to know that is, A, through pre-planning and training, but also through a victim profile where you ask questions. Where are they? Where are the victims, alleged victims? Or how many of them are there? Where are they located? Well, they're in the back bathroom. Well, that tells you right there, this is a savable, tenable space. And now perhaps we can flank it and go and basically do a VES from an adjacent wall and go in and pull them out. So really important that everyone listening understands how important that is. Survivability profile is very important for our own safety. We don't want folks to firefighters to get hurt or, heaven forbid, perish unnecessarily. However, we have to go deeper and ask questions. Where are the victims? How many? Where are they last seen? And that can give us more information to make the right tackle decision like these guys just did. So Excellent. Any questions, Brian?
No, but I do just want to highlight, because, you know, hearing it both from the captain and from the battalion chief, and you and I having a recent discussion about this, I do think that this is one of those evolutions we'll see in our time, again, with fire behavior and UL in this studies, is that where once building construction was talked to a high degree, you could hear, you know, that maybe the more pressing issue is building compartmentalization. You know, the first new officer coming on scene and considering the compartmentalization of the occupancy, and then also, you know, the battalion chief coming on scene and recognizing that while I'm seeing fire, there's a lot of compartments that I'm not seeing. And I do kind of just want to turn up the volume on you know, obviously you're speaking about the victim profiling and understanding those places and them knowing known location, known victim. But the kind of compartmentalization, highlighting that is a big thing going forward.
And I think everybody
the other aspect
of snapshot of this blog can attest to fires they've been in apartments or houses where the majority of the interior of the structure is well involved. After the fact, it's charred, there's smoke staining everywhere, but there might be one bathroom or one bedroom that behind just a simple hollow core door is pristine. And I think that's what you described after the fact. Am I right, Sean, that after it was all said and done, that that bathroom where the child and the father were virtually unscathed by soot and products of combustion, is that right?
Yeah, it did have – there was a fair amount of smoke in it, but there was no heat. And so, like when
right.
I said, when we came across them, they were unresponsive or unconscious. I would attest
right.
to that being from the smoke inhalation that they did have, but
absolutely,
in comparison
yeah.
to the rest of their building, it by far was protected.
Exactly, and it was a savable space. It was a tenable space. Yes, they were unconscious. Had they stayed in that position and not been rescued by you, they would have certainly perished. However, in that window of time, that where they were still savable, unconscious, which is a miracle, because had the father been conscious, who knows what he would have done to you guys trying to come into that bathroom.
Exactly.
You know? He could have cut your arms. He could have cut your face. He could have pretended to be unconscious and then waited for you to come in and killed one of you guys. So
yeah.
The window of time to where he was unconscious but not dead, I mean, it's just a miracle. I just sometimes you look at these calls and say, all right, God must have been watching over everybody in this one, because it was miraculous.
Yeah, we were talking – when we talked on the phone the first time and I was describing, it wasn't something you thought about during the incident. Actually, I was more upset about it during the incident, but it ended up being something very fortunate to all the parties involved, was the fact that we were blocked by the cops. If we had the ability to pull straight out of the apartment, my first inclination would have been fire attack. And that's where I would have focused, was fire attack, pushing in and then trying to make a rescue going that route. But the fact that I was blocked by the police officers, which, you know, upset me at the time, made me be in that position where I didn't have a hose in my hand. I didn't have water nearby. All I had were my tools, and I wanted to be of some assistance. I wanted to help somehow. And so it kind of focused, instead of fire attack, it focused me a little bit more on taking that second of situational awareness, taking a step back, thinking about what I could do to make a difference. So
yeah,
it was very exactly. fortunate for all parties involved. And like you said, it's hard to deny a higher power when all those things line up just perfect to,
yeah.
to make a difference.
Yep, it really is, brother. Been in your shoes in that sense. Now, for those listening, I think one of the lessons that you're maybe intentionally or otherwise putting out there is, look, you know, our most firefighters' instinct is to put water on the fire. That's the first thing you want to do. And like you said, had you not been forced into a position where you didn't have that option, you probably would have done that. And, you know, who knows what the outcome would have been. But it certainly would have taken longer to get to the victims. And
absolutely.
This is why VES, yeah, and this is why VES is so critical. But we don't always have the option for VES, case in point. Or what if this was a without a perpetrator or violent crime situation? What if this is five or six stories up in the air on an apartment building? You don't have the luxury of VES through a window, but and they're in the bathroom or they're in some other type of part of the apartment. where maybe you can go adjacent and breach the adjacent wall. And this is a tactic we've been teaching in our class for a long time about going into an adjacent unit and knowing, if you know your first two area and you know that this is mirrored on the other side, you know, if I'm in a bathroom, I'm going to breach into a bathroom. If I'm in a bedroom, I'm going to breach into the bedroom. And this is the exact scenario that, case in point, that Williams works just perfectly. So, Chief Keeley, from a command and tactical standpoint, could you kind of tell us what role you were in? You were division at the tactical level. What were you coordinating along with the rescue efforts that were going on within your division? What else was going on around you and above you?
Yeah, so due to the layout of the building, I was a division where the rescues were occurring and fire attack was needed. The roof division was assigned by command and answered to command, and there was a division Charlie on the backside that was conducting evacuations. And there was a little bit of fire in the attic space above the second story on the backside, so they had to pull some lines back there as well. But on the front side, where I was at, it's so beneficial to have a tactical supervisor that's forward, because our incident commander, because of the – Captain Lemon alluded to the fact that this is a really difficult access for the apartment. So the second engine that took a separate entrance than 42s, effectively, just because of the layout of the driveway, blocked any visibility from any other resource arriving. So our incident commander, Battalion 5 Chief Peck, was three rigs back, and all he could see was the glow and flames coming from above the roof line. So as a tactical supervisor moving forward, taking a division and or a group, you are that eyes and ears for the IC and giving benchmark can reports. And then when crews would come forward for an assignment, like Engine 103, Captain Montgomery came up to me and said, "We're here, what do you need?" And I said, "You got to go into that Delta 1 unit because 42's in there making a rescue. Go help them with that rescue." And like Captain Lemon just said earlier, 103's captain got there in exactly the right amount of time to help them pull that adult male out of that hole that they had made to breach. And I don't think that would have happened had there just been single resource assignments for fire attack and search, because that intel is not there. And that one point of contact is not there. And we have a tendency to oftentimes use the radio too much. And this was definitely no exception. The radio was crazy. And you can imagine, I mean, we have two alarms worth of resources. We have heavy fire in multiple apartments. We have a known rescue of an infant. We have law enforcement on scene. So the radio is going to be difficult to use and transmit on. So having that ability to be forward, get that intel from the guys that are working on the inside, and then make effective assignments based on what you can actually see is critical for the success of these complex incidents.
Exactly. And that's why we preach bridging the tactical gap as soon as possible with division and group supervisors. You know, some would say, well, why didn't the incident commander just come forward to where you were and run the fire from there? What would be some of your comments on that? What would have happened if you were the IC responsible for the entire thing in that tactical space up close and personal versus back where he was?
Well, he would have to manage multiple radio channels with, you know, so we did initiate a communications plan once the other battalion chiefs got there to establish those divisions. So we had our command channel, and then we had the original TAC channel, Alpha 6, secondary TAC channel, Alpha 7 for the Division Charlie, and then one if this incident had expanded. So to be able to effectively listen to multiple tactical channels and a command channel away from your vehicle, that in itself presents a major challenge. You're going to miss radio communication. And then having our MDC on these larger incidents, Chief Peck went to the back of his rig. We have an MDC screen on the backside. We have two radios on the backside. We also have our portable radios that we can turn on. And we have some whiteboards that we can, dry erase boards that we can write our assignments and our resources for resource tracking. So the ability to track two alarms on a commercial fire, working fire with multiple divisions, would be extremely difficult, if not impossible. So for the IC to be able to remain at the command post, and also to have a really good point of contact, like if you needed somebody to meet someone somewhere, the incident command post is a great place to do it. And also with a law enforcement component, we struggled to get a law enforcement agency representative to the command post, but I had a really good conversation with a couple of lieutenants after this incident saying how critical it is that we have one of their members, whether it's a patrol officer, a sergeant, or whatever, that comes to the command post because they speak a different language, they have different comms, and they might be getting really good information that we need, but there's going to be a massive delay in order to get it from one side to the next. So having that remote incident commander at their vehicle serves a lot of purposes, from resource tracking to almost a unified command with law enforcement and a point of contact. So
that's perfect, and you know, that's why we talk about that tactical space between the incident commander and the crew's work. There's options. One option is for the IC to move forward, but then you're wrought with all the issues you just said, including sensory overload and getting sucked into the tasks, and that's potential micromanaging and tunnel visioning because you're too close to it. So you have to have those tactical supervisors, like you said, who are the eyes and ears of the incident commander on multiple levels. And so you had, if I recall, you said yourself, another division in the other side of the building, and then roof, correct?
That's correct. And then there was staging, and there wasn't a medical group, but there were ambulances assigned. So, and the IC was responsible for the medical component as well. So,
Right. Excellent. Well, you guys hit a grand slam in the bottom of the ninth of the seventh game of the World Series here, and this was just phenomenal. Go ahead. Keep the conversation going.
I did have one question. It was, you know, you bring up a good point about having that communication with the law enforcement, and I understand that in SAC Metro. EMS and fires is one and the same. You guys are a fire-based EMS system. One thing I did kind of want to talk to you about is obviously it's multifamily dwelling anyway. You had one pediatric patient transported, then you're transporting this adult male. You know, what was your medical group built out with? And then also, you know, in the agencies that I've worked with, when we had any type of hostile kind of patient, or certainly in this case, having law enforcement ride in with them, was there a law enforcement present with this patient on the transport?
I don't have confirmation that there was, but in our typical practice where we have a subject that is an assailant or something that law enforcement wants to make sure that they keep their hands on, they generally either send a member in the ambulance with us, or they have the police vehicle is following our ambulance to the hospital. So they're either present or right behind. And I don't know on this one which one they were. But I'm sure that they didn't just leave him to us to take to the hospital. And then, because from what I heard, he did awaken early in transport and became relatively combative with pulling leads off, trying to pull IVs out and stuff like that. I don't think he was violent towards our crews, but he was just combative. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, and then how did the rest of the medical group go then? Were you bringing in a couple more ambulances due to the multifamily dwelling? Or?
So, yes, we had a total of 5 ambulances assigned and 4 patients transported on this one. Our typical assignment, we will get one ambulance for the first alarm and then an additional ambulance for the second alarm. And then with the IC's knowledge of 2 victims already being pulled out and the potential for multiple others, because of the time of day and the dwelling itself, he had called for 3 additional ambulances besides the 2 that came with the first and second alarm.
Yeah, so
and
once
we'll
again,
we have
just adding
captain.
To
We do have an EMS captain that is on our shift, and so he I don't know this to be part of the incident command structure, but typically that EMS captain becomes our medical group supervisor. So I would have expected that Chief Peck would have assigned medical group to our EMS 24.
And for those of you listening at home, the reason why Chief Peck isn't on the show is because he is basking in the glow of Hawaii right now, everybody. We didn't want to bug him when he was in Hawaii, so that's why he's not here. There was a question that came up, maybe not so much a question as it was, how important was it, because some departments don't have multiple tactical channels, like you mentioned, Chief Key, and you know, to your point, it is hard to monitor multiple channels. What does the face-to-face communication that you were conducting within your division, how does that reduce radio traffic and also help with accountability?
Well, yeah. I mean, obviously those transmissions that would normally have to go over the radio are now just handled from the group supervisor, division supervisor to the company officer. So being able to talk directly to Engine 103's captain and point to the apartment that he needs to go in there to assist Engine 42 with the rescue, and having Engine 101's captain come up to me and say, what do you need? And I said, I need fire tech right there. Like, we need a line on this. And then directing 24's crew to go upstairs and assist with the attic fire, and truck 106's crew to make access for the crews that are fighting the attic fire. So those are all face-to-face comms that I had that had nothing to do with clogging up the radio. So I was able to, once radio traffic calmed down and I was a division, I was able to transmit out that we had one victim coming out to the command post. And so he had the ambulance with the gurney ready at the command post to receive that victim. And then when victim number two, the adult male, came out, same thing. I transmitted that second victim's been removed. He's coming to the command post so that that second ambulance could have their gurney there to receive that guy as well. So face-to-face communication, nothing substitutes for it, because even radio comms, you can try and describe something, and if you're not looking at it, you may miss the message. So being able to have that group supervisor, division supervisor up front with eyes on the incident itself, and being able to have those face-to-face comms and point and tell them exactly what you need, and then you can see the effectiveness immediately, and then you can either say, I got enough people in my division, I don't need any more because we're getting knocked down, or this thing's extending to the Bravo units, give me another engine company with a hose line to initiate fire attack on the Bravo 1 exposure. So critical information to have, and then the accountability side, we know where our people are operating. So if there's anything that goes wrong on the incident, we know right where they are and who they are, and we'll have people near us to make that situation better as well.
And I just want to jump in from kind of a captain's standpoint, how beneficial it is as well. Throughout the incident, watching my video, there was probably four different times I tried keying up my mic in the first handful of minutes to get a transmission out, and I wasn't able to because other people were talking. And it's extremely frustrating when you feel like you have something you really needed to get out. And, you know, as the incident progressed, it became much easier for me to get traffic out. That being said, after the victims were taken out, I personally did face-to-face contact with Chief Keeley probably five or six times, as he gave me different assignments for secondary searches or to limit access to certain areas or stuff like that. And it, like you said, it provides that clarity for both parties involved that we understand the assignment, we understand the expectations. And then beyond that, he was saying, having somebody who can point, I want something there. He's continually reassessing, continually checking what decision points he wants to jump on, or watching the overall scene evolve and make better decisions than somebody who's back off, back at their rig and doesn't have eyes on in the same way. So at least from my standpoint, having a chief officer up close within contact of face-to-face is huge.
Outstanding. It is huge. And that's what we talk about when we say, you know, being in the next, the tactical supervisor must be thinking in the next ahead of where you are at the task level. You're thinking right now, I got to breach this wall and get this kid out. And he's thinking behind you, what are the fire conditions above you? What help do you need? Do you need another company? Do you need a medic? And so he's anticipating your needs, and he's sizing up things that you can't possibly see at the task level because you're just down in the hole working. And that's what's critical. And so even having the IC up close and personal does not replace multiple division group supervisors doing that on behalf of the IC. And that's
when you have those division group soups, bridging that gap, thinking in the next, accounting for crews, that allows the IC to step back and get in what we call the then what if. Then I'm going to, you know, I got to deal with this attic fire. What if I have a mayday? You know, what if we have another victim? What if somebody gets, you know, stabbed or shot? And thinking contingencies on something as crazy as this was. So just great job, fellas. Just phenomenal work. Made me very proud to have been a member of Metro 5 to hear how you handled this fire, Sean. And just gives me a lot of joy knowing that Metro Fire is in good hands and that you guys killed it. Now you said that you were doing some other stuff. I probably got another bottle and probably got reassigned to Chief Keeley's division. At what point were you doing other work, like, you know, doing a secondary search here, taking up hose there, where it actually hit you what you had just done? When did it hit you? Like, or was it back at the station, or when did it hit you that, oh, my gosh, we actually just saved two people?
It's funny. I think it kind of came in waves, like a little bit at a time. Like you said, as soon as we had gotten the victims out, we were both on Viber alert, so we did a bottle swap and then went right back to work. So in that situation, we didn't really take too much time to think about what we'd done other than high-five each other right after it happened. But it was when I got back to the station and I started receiving phone calls and my cell phone started blowing up and people were talking about how insane it was that, you know, you start reflecting and you start thinking back about what had actually happened. And then I got goosebumps. We took the time when we got back, we both had our GoPros, we uploaded the videos and we're watching it and like hitting those certain points where the baby's in your hands and you're yelling out as loud as you can, you know, for somebody to come help you. You know, it gives you those goosebumps of like, that's crazy. That kid's still alive, you know? And then obviously moving on to the other male, it's the same type of feeling, but I would definitely say it's one of those things where you don't think about it at the time. And I probably still haven't really had a full sink in of how unique and how maybe once in a career this might be. But it, like I said, it very little of this was my doing other than just acting. Everything else, I mean, so many other people and so many other factors contributed to making this possible.
Hey, Cap, can we build on that real quick? You talked about the recency of some firefighter survival training, and man, when I hear this about breaching the wall and two firefighters going in and getting the victims out, it almost is to a T a lot of the RIT drills that we'll do where you're breaching a wall and you have to go through the low profile prop and access this person. But you did talk about how you then had a 250-pound male just wearing boxer shorts. Clearly your training prepped you for all of this, but do you feel that maybe that's something we should be incorporating into these drills is using a victim that doesn't have the air pack to convert or the bunker gear to grab or those types of things? Do you feel that that added to the challenges here to have a straight up dead weight victim?
Oh, absolutely. Victim. I mean, you think about, like you were saying, like our typical drills will be, you know, a set weight mannequin with plenty of things to grab onto. Your access, your egress is usually ground level. If, you know what I mean, you either have a small hole or it's ground level, you can just pull them through. It's definitely all about making it more and more difficult, realistic, but more difficult. And I would say this was one of those that obviously didn't fall into the same mold as what we typically train on. I mean, this guy was soaking wet, sitting, soaking in a bathtub, larger than most of our mannequins we'll get to. But instead of having his egress ground level, we had to lift him up above our waist to get him up and out, almost like a windowsill. I would say, and that's something that I think at Metro we try to work on, is more thinking outside the box. How can we make training a little more entertaining instead of the same old thing? And I think that's kind of where we go back to, we're putting the whole department through firefighter survival. And we're putting on all these trainings where we're hearing from other firefighters, not only from our agency, but other agencies, about lessons learned and things that were outside the box. And just by those things being promoted and those things being talked about, maybe not in the conscious, but more in the subconscious, they're always rattling around back there. And it provides those ideas when those opportunities present themselves.
Well said. Well said. You know what? And this was
3 o'clock in the morning, finishing out your first shift of a 48, correct?
Yeah, correct.
So you had a whole other 24 hours at work, and I bet you that next medical aid you got, I don't care if who it was or what they had, they got the best care on the planet on that medical aid.
We were happy to be there. We were smiling.
That's right. All of a sudden, those calls that we don't like going on, we call them BS calls or whatever. It's like, no way, man, we're going to give this person the best freaking care on the planet.
It's all worth it after still, that. That makes them all worth it.
It is. Exactly. Well, like you said, you can't control when this happens, but you did control your training. You controlled your attitude, your leadership, and you took full advantage of what you did have control over. And I hope everyone listening to this can learn something from it. I know they will. Like I mentioned, the timing, it could be better. We've been teaching this tactic for a long time, and people kind of look at cross-eyed at us when they talk about it, but you just proved that it can be a very, very important and timely tactic that could save lives. And don't be surprised if the fire service starts building props and they call it the 42 drill. That'd be awesome. Do you have any other questions, Chief Brush?
No, man. This has been absolutely outstanding. I really appreciate you guys sharing the story while it's still so fresh, and just applaud your efforts and a tip of the hat to SAC Metro for, the empowerment in that first new company officer to make these types of decisions, and then down the line, your trust in the other companies to handle the fire while you're handling the rescue. I mean, this is, as we talked about just before the show, you know, a lot of things are systematic, but it's because the mission is systemic. And from top to bottom, it's clear that this is a mission-driven organization with very positive outcomes.
For sure. Chief Keeley, any more thoughts?
No, I really appreciate the opportunity to share our experiences, and my hat's off to 42 and the rest of the men and women at Metro Fire. This was an extremely challenging incident, and our guys and gals handled it professionally and exceptionally, and I'm proud to work alongside each and every one of them.
And last but not least, Captain Sean Lemon, Engine 42. Charlie, you have the last word, brother. What do you want to say?
I just want to thank you guys for giving us an outlet to talk about this. That being said, you know, just talking about the department as a whole and the high trust aid they give us and the ability to make those decisions and knowing that if we make them for the right reasons, that we got the backing of the full force of the department with us. But also the unique opportunity to be on a podcast with two chief officers that at least I can speak for myself have come up through this department looking up to. It was kind of funny. You called me and you're like, hey, does this name sound familiar? And I'm like, yeah, Chief, how are you? Of course it does. Like, we definitely know you guys. We appreciate the work you guys put in, especially in this podcast. My wife even listens to him, if I'm being honest. Yeah, she works for a department up in Nevada. But, no, we appreciate the time, and this has been a unique experience, and I thank you for it.
Well, again, congratulations. God bless. And everybody listening out there, you know, we can't say it enough. It's not – you can't control what's going to come at you, but you can control your preparation for it. So visit us at trainfirefighters.com. We're doing Calm the Chaos, Mastering Fire Ground Command all over the country. It's online now. It's an online program, too. And this is the exact kind of stuff we're talking about and teaching, so we hope you reach out to us. If you're looking for promotion, get a hold of us as well for the online assessment center class. Gentlemen, thank you for your time. Thank you for this amazing story and fantastic work. And God bless you. God bless your families, those you serve, those you lead, and God bless the fire service. Thanks, everybody.